Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Rahm. I'm so happy to have all of you listening. However you listen, whenever you listen, wherever you listen, we want to thank you so much for joining us here on Suspense Radio. A couple of brief things before we get in is this is going to be our last show till April 26th. We are taking a little extended vacation we are going on, but all the shows, Crime and Science Radio, Stranger and Fiction, those things will be going on. So don't forget to listen to them. Today's show, we got two fabulous authors coming up for you. First is going to be author Sandra Parcell with her Richard Goddard mystery series, latest book called Poison Ground. And then we're going to head over here to William Nickel, and he is going to be talking about his Jack Farrell adventure series with Cave Dweller being re-released, coming back out, and all of his books going to be coming back out. So sit back, relax, enjoy, because 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
So welcome back, everybody, to the show. Again, I want to thank you all for listening, however, whenever you listen. Thank you again for the Suspense Radio support and the Suspense Magazine support. Let's jump right in here now to our first guest. Like we said, she is the author of the Rachel Goddard mystery series. The latest book is called Poison Ground. You can find her on the Internet with her website, sandraparshall.com, P-A-R-S-H-A-L-L. So, Sandra, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing this morning or this afternoon?
I'm fine. It's one o'clock in the afternoon where I am in Northern Virginia. I'm really delighted to be here. I love Suspense Magazine. I love the interviews you do on this show, and I'm happy to be part of it.
Well, I thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate having you on here. And again, talking with about your mystery series, Rachel Goddard. And the latest book, like we said, is called Poison Ground. It is out now. People can go out and get it wherever they buy books. So why don't you give us a little bit of the background information here of Poison Ground?
Poison Ground is, it's a murder mystery, but it's also a suspense novel. The action gets underway when an outside development company comes into this little mountain community where my books are set. They have the idea of turning this place into a huge resort for the rich, and they want to buy up a lot of farmland, and half the people in the community are against it, half are for it. You know, the people who are desperate for jobs think that any kind of job is great, even if it's the worst kind of job you can imagine, with no benefits whatsoever. The others are, you know, some of the land that this company wants it belongs to people who don't want to sell it. They're very happy with their way of life, and they want to
We might have lost Ray. We might have lost. Oh, we did lose Sandra. That's all right. We'll get her back on. I'm sure she'll call back here in a second. That's live radio technology for you people. So stuff like this happens. And it's okay, we don't panic, but we do have to take a drink, and that's what I'm going to do. So, again, Sandra Parshall is the author, and you can go to sandraparshall.com. This is her fifth book in her Rachel Goddard series, starting back with The Heat of the Moon and moving its way through. When you go to her website, you'll be able to find out all the information here on her books. And exactly like she says, it's when she explains, I mean, she was talking about what we face here. Of course, whenever we vote in the United States, you have 50% one way, 50% the other way. There's really no consensus. So when you have those things, I mean, things happen. And Sandra, I believe, is back. Sandra, we lost you, but we got you back.
Yeah, I'm back.
That's all right. Okay, So go ahead again. So the book is set, like you said, in your Northern Virginia small little community. Things are going on. 50% of the people like the idea. 50% of the people don't like the idea. Like I said, it kind of feels like the United States, where it's like half and
right.
half. I mean, that's just right. real world. So go ahead.
But as my character, Rachel Goddard, is the local veterinarian, and she's recently married the local sheriff, Tom Bridger, and he's new in the job, so he has, he's grown up here, he knows everybody, so investigating any kind of crime is tricky for him because he knows everybody, and there are expectations that he will go easy on people and so forth, that he'll be nice to his friends and so on, yet he has to do his job. Rachel is very outspoken in her opposition to the development, so she's not making his job any easier. This creates strife between them and their marriage, in their new marriage. But as the investigation goes on, it becomes clear that the this development idea, the fight over money and land sales and so on, has just stirred up a lot of old grievances from the past. They're being dredged up to the surface by all this commotion in the present, and that often happens. When people start fighting about something that's current, they start dragging up everything from the past, and that's what's going on in this book. And the motive for the murders, turns out to be pretty personal in the end. And Rachel and her husband are caught right in the middle of it.
And now, this is the fifth or the sixth Rachel Goddard series?
This is number six.
Okay, that's what I thought, number six. And it goes back to where your first one, The Heat of the Moon, is when you kind of introduced the character. And now that she's come back, and of course, Heat of the Moon won the Agatha Award for Best Novel in 2006. So starting back then, looking forward, I mean, when you come out of the gate, you're winning the Agatha Award, so then you knew you had something going on. I mean, what motivation to go ahead, and now you're six books into the series?
Well, I'll tell you, when I wrote The Heat of the Moon, I never dreamed it would be the beginning of the series. I wrote it as a standalone suspense novel, psychological suspense. It was set in Northern Virginia, the Washington suburbs where Rachel lived at the time. And it was all about her struggle to find out the truth about her family background, which is very murky, and her mother, who's a very controlling psychologist, does not want her asking a lot of questions about her dead father, about the father's background, where they came from, what the family's history is, and so on. At the end of that book, I didn't think that I had started a series, but when I sold mm-hmm. the book, my publisher wanted more about Rachel, and I did have a lot more to say about her, as it turned out. And after all the awful things I did to her in that first book, I moved her out to a new setting in the mountains, in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, so she could start over, you know, away from all the bad memories. But, of course, bad memories follow you wherever you go. And it has taken – I have a definite arc of development for Rachel through these books. So if you read them from the beginning, you can see her development from that very frightened and confused young woman in the first book to a very strong and decisive woman in this latest book that I've written. I think she's developed into a very strong person over the course of the books. So I'm glad that I have had the chance to let that happen to her and go along on that journey with her, because I've come to really admire her and like her a lot. I'd love to have her as a friend.
And that's an important thing, that you are just so familiar with your character, almost like a sister, like a family member, somebody that you go through the trials and tribulations with through the book. It gives the reader that sense of emotion that the author is putting in, making it really understand where the character is coming from, where you as the author are trying to, you know, point and give them their livelihood and kind of how things are progressing. And I find it interesting that you didn't really think that you were going to write a series with the beginning of The Heat of the Moon. So were you scrambling? Were you finding things when you started to realize that this was going to be a series? How long did you have to kind of work yourself together to now build a bigger background for her as you move forward?
Actually, it was kind of a relief, because I had left her at the end of the first book. I had left her in a sort of uncertain state. And, you know, you could imagine a future for her, but it could be a bad future, it could be a good one. And I was actually relieved to be able to move forward with her and put her in another place, let her become a stronger person. I enjoyed it. I welcomed it. It was a wonderful experience. And also, that first book was psychological suspense. The second book was a murder mystery. And I introduced Tom Bridger, who was at that time a deputy sheriff out in this new community that she moved to, called Mason County, Virginia, which is an invention of my own. It's out there somewhere around Roanoke in my mind. And that was the first murder mystery that I had ever tried to write. And it was a new experience. It was very challenging. And it turned out to be a very complex story, and a very dark story, with a lot of characters, a lot of different subplots and interactions among the characters. And so continuing with Rachel has made me grow as a writer, has let me do things that I never thought I would do. And I owe a lot to Rachel. I've learned a lot from writing about her.
And so now we go into book six, and now we're into Poison Ground. And like when people read about what the book is and fans that know coming up, now they see that, of course, her husband is now a sheriff, just newly elected. So now he has more responsibilities, more things going on. How is that dynamic now kind of working when Rachel's kind of the veterinarian? Now you have the sheriff. How are those things kind of, you know, going to kind of work together? As far as she's kind of the star, he's like the lawman.
Well, I have never really liked books in which an amateur sleuth makes the cops look like idiots. I have a lot of respect for law enforcement, and I think that detectives in general are pretty smart people. And so I let Tom do most of the police work. But Rachel she's part of the community. And as a veterinarian, she knows a lot of people. She makes house calls. She goes into people's homes. She learns things. People tell her things. And she comes across a lot of information that her husband might not ever be privy to because people are afraid to talk to him or won't approach him. She can be his eyes and ears in places where he normally would not be welcome. And often people don't realize that they're helping to solve a crime when they tell Rachel something, but they are.
Right.
But he's a typical husband. He wants to protect his wife, and he doesn't like her being in danger, and she sometimes oversteps the boundaries and goes into places and does things that she shouldn't do, but it's usually because she's trying to protect somebody else. She's one of those people who just cannot stand by and let somebody else get hurt, especially if it's a child. And she's very protected toward animals, being a veterinarian, of course.
Sure.
Anybody who is an underdog, Rachel is going to be there to defend that person. And it's such a strong instinct in her that she is usually unable to hold herself back. And she knows sometimes that she's going a little too far, but she can't help herself. You know, if she's in the moment and she sees somebody being hurt, she's going to step in and stop it if she can. So that's the kind of person she is, and she can't, it's her basic nature. She can't really change herself. But most of the time she's pretty sensible, and she's more of a help to Tom than a hindrance. But he would, you know, he'd really like it if she were just, you know, a normal wife and, you know, went to her, did her own job, and they had a normal relationship and their jobs never overlapped. But in this small community, it's inevitable that their jobs are going to overlap because they know the same people, they get involved in the same issues. And in this case, Rachel is, she's just adamantly opposed to this development because she can see the damage that it's going to do in the community. And Tom would like her to be quiet about it and not get involved, but it's her community too. You know, she lives here too. She has a business. She's put every cent she ever had into this business, and this place matters to her. It's her home now, and she doesn't want to see it destroyed by this outside company that she considers to be predatory and destructive. So she can't help herself. She's got to do something.
And now with the sixth book, you have a complement of many different secondary characters that you've had to create along the line through the series now going on. Is there one in particular that kind of stands out in your mind that really just keeps having a bigger voice than you thought would originally happen, and they just keep popping themselves back up in your books?
Well, there are characters who show up in every book. There's Joanna McKendrick, who owns a horse farm, is a good friend of Rachel's. When Rachel first moved to Mason County, she stayed in a little cottage on Joanna's horse farm, and that's where she was living in the second book when Rachel first moved to Mason County. And she has appeared in each book. In this latest book, she is right in the center of the story because her horse farm, which is probably the most successful business in the entire county, that is the property that this development company most wants. They're trying to take that land. They are really putting the pressure on Joanna to sell that land to them because it's just perfect for their purpose. And Joanna is very much opposed to selling. She loves it. She loves her work. She loves her horses and her business, and she has no intention of selling, but she's got, you know, half the county pressuring her to give up everything that is important to her. And so she has a big role in this book, and there are other minor characters that have, you know, sort of been important in one book and been in the background in others. And I'm fond of all of them. and I've loved introducing new characters in each book too. And in this book, I have three elderly sisters, the Jones sisters, who are named for the seasons. There's winter, spring, and summer. And there was an autumn too, but she has been dead for many years, and that's important to the story, but you don't find out why until somewhat later in the book. But I loved writing them. You know, they were the kind of characters that write their own dialogue. You just start a scene with them and they start talking, and all you have to do is write down what they say. They're a little bit crazy, but, you know, you come to find out that there is a method to the madness. You know, behind everything they say, there's a reason, there's a purpose. So I loved writing about them. I have no idea where they came from. They just walked into my head one day, and I put them in the book, and they turned out to be very useful.
And that's always good, kind of a nice little surprise, and bam, there you go. You find something that you didn't really think you'd find.
Right, yeah. It's the characters that you really... those are the characters that turn out best, I think. You know, they seem the most vivid, the ones that just come to you out of nowhere, because your subconscious is delivering them to you. It's the ones that you really have to strain for and, you know, work and labor to construct. Those are the ones that never really come alive, and you probably should just toss aside because they're never going to be more than cardboard. I just, you know, unless they just walk into your mind and assume vivid life in your head, they're never going to be vividly alive on the page, as far as I'm concerned anyway.
And when you're kind of looking now through the journey, was there something that clicked that made you decide this is the kind of stories I want to write? Was there a certain book? Was there something that got you going on to be able for you to sit down and say, hey, you know what, it's time for me to start this series, and then The Heat of the Moon kind of came out?
Well, I had written a number of books that I couldn't get published. And I guess they were mainstream or literary. As I look back on them now, I realize that every one of them had some kind of a crime in it. But yeah. I didn't think of them as crime novels. And they were just a hodgepodge. You know, I had agents. I had several agents. But I never sold anything. And I never dreamed that I loved reading mysteries. I loved suspense more than anything. I loved reading suspense novels. I never dreamed that I could write something like that. But then I had a dream about two little girls who were out in a rainstorm by themselves crying for their mother. And when I woke up, I couldn't shake that image. I couldn't get rid of that dream. And I wanted to know who they were. You know, why were they out there alone? Where was their mother? What was going on there? And I started writing, and that was the origin of The Heat of the Moon. I wrote that book to answer all those questions that my dream raised in my head. And I, you know, that was the beginning. After that, I've never wanted to write any other kind of book. I want to write crime fiction, suspense, and mysteries. From now on, I want to write what I love to read.
And I think that's very important, is that not only do you know, you write what you love to read, which gives you that passion to wake up and that motivation to keep going when, you know, when the times kind of get tough and the times kind of get rough and maybe you hit some of those mental, you know, those mental blocks.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. So now we got about a minute left. Is there some events you're going to? How can people kind of contact you, maybe ask some questions, find out, you know, all these kinds of more information?
Well, on my website, and my website was recently totally redesigned. I wish everybody would go look at it. I'm so proud of it. I think it's beautiful.
It's very nice. It's very easy to go around. Yeah, it's very easy to navigate around.
It's really great. I really love it. It's sandraparshall.com. And on the contact page, there's a form for contacting me. It will go directly, your message will go directly to my email. And I love to hear from readers. I love questions. I love comments. I love to get email from readers. So anybody who wants to email me, please feel welcome to.
Well, Sandra, we want to thank you so much for coming on and giving us a little bit more information, of course, about Poison Ground and about, you know, the Rachel Goddard and everything else that you have going on. It's fabulous to be able to see, you know, six books in and you're still going strong, and I'm sure book seven is either already done or very, very close. And Rachel's just going to continue on along with you.
Well, I'm going to write a suspense novel next, and before I return to Rachel, but I hope that people will like the next book as much as the others.
Well, we'll look forward to it, and we want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
All right, Sandra, we will talk with you soon. Enjoy, and again, thanks again.
Thank you, John.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is Sandra Parshall, and her website is Sandra, PARSHALL.com. For more information, go there and find out more about Poison Ground, which is the latest book, book six in the Rachel Goddard mystery series. Don't miss out. We are going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest. He is William Nichol. His books are Jack Farrell Adventure Books. Very interesting stuff he's got going on here. Cave Dweller is going to be a re-release available here on March 25th along with his other series. So we're going to get William on here in just a second. And in the meantime, entertain yourself with this.
It's time for a face-off where mystery meets suspense. Join us at the 9th Annual Thriller Fest. Learn from top industry leaders and authors at CraftFest. Get your story heard by industry professionals at PitchFest. Celebrate the new 2014 Thriller Master Scott Turow, along with 2013 Thriller Master Anne Rice, Silver Bullet winner Brenda Novak, and a list of special guests you'll have to see to believe. July 8th through the 12th at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, the premier conference for thriller enthusiasts, those who read them, and those who write them. And find out about the new ITW anthology Face-Off, where the world's greatest thriller characters meet head-to-head in 11 electrifying stories. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
everybody, welcome here after the break of Suspense Radio. We want to thank you again all for joining us and listening wherever you guys are doing it. We really appreciate the support here that we have for Suspense Radio and Suspense Magazine. And again, we want to thank Sandra Parshall for coming on and being our first guest and talking about her book, Poison Ground. We are going to jump now into our next guest. He is the book. His Jack Sparrow Adventure Series is coming out. And if you go on his website, his name is William Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L. The one thing that is always funny when you look at authors, the book is actually going to be available March 25th, 2014. Even though he says 2013, that's okay. It's coming out here in the next couple of days. So, William, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good. Thank you for having me on, John.
So there's nothing wrong with having a little edit, just to let you know that, you know, on your website you say March 25th, 2013, but we all are a year behind in certain things. So you might... So just so you know, you might want to
that can be rectified. Yeah, I think I've been an entire year behind for several years.
But Cave Dweller, like we said, the book has been out. Jack Sparrow has been out. You have books that have already kind of come out. This is kind of a relaunch to kind of get people to understand exactly, you know, who William Nickel is, what the kind of books are about, and we're starting off with Cave Dweller. So give everybody a little bit about not just the book, but who is Jack Sparrow and who is William Nickel?
Jack Sparrow. Jack Sparrow's a protagonist that I created when I moved here to the Hawaiian Islands. Hawaii's rich in legend, and I started, you know, getting ideas for stories and came up with the idea that Jack Sparrow needed to be somebody associated with the ocean and diving, and came up with him being a marine biologist. Initially, Jack Sparrow is here like a lot of the people, here being Maui. They come here for various reasons, usually personal reasons, and then they either leave or, you know, kind of fade into the woodwork. Jack Sparrow came here in the initial book, Glimmer of Gold. Jack Sparrow comes here in a relationship with a woman that's not working out. And yes, we have. And initially, you know, he's a nobody. You know, he's got aspirations in life, but the girlfriend's rich, and so he's kind of living off her, but he doesn't like it. And one day he's diving on a reef, and he finds a ring. And the ring is a World War II, belonged to a World War II soldier. It was a West Point class ring, and he begins to get curious who the soldier was, how he lost it, and so he starts tracing the owner of the ring, and it actually ends up taking him into a story on the mainland where the ring is evidence in a murder where a man was falsely accused, and the ring turns out to be the evidence that gets him out of prison. And in the process, he meets Katie and realizes there's more to his life than just sitting on the island. And he then goes to finish his degree in marine biology. And that's where Jack is actually born. In the subsequent books, Night Marchers and Cave Dweller, which I have to say is my very favorite, but in the subsequent books, he is already a marine biologist. And working as a marine biologist, he gets involved in different situations that actually has to do with Hawaiian legend. Night Marchers being the ghosts ghosts of ancient warriors that wander the island. And I wove a story around that. It doesn't have to do with ghosts, but that's the legend that's involved. And then in Cave Dweller, we have the Menahuni. Menahuni are fascinating. Every country has its legends of little people, you know, leprechauns, dwarves. Hawaii's is the Menahuni. And here in Hawaii, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I thought it was very interesting.
They are. They're very interesting. The Menahuni are generally depicted as busy little workers who, like, feverishly complete walls and ditches and other projects during the night. They're also depicted as being kind of mischievous. It's like if you're vacationing over here and you put your keys on the table, and then you get up in the morning and you look for them, and they're not there. Well, everybody says the Menahuni came in during the night and took them. That's the explanation for all these little pranks that go on. But generally, they're kind of depicted as kind of being Smurf-like. But the legends, the true legends, depict them as being as like a race of small people that once inhabited the islands, and who, in trying to avoid a larger race of people, preferred performing their tasks in the darkness of night. I took that legend and was intrigued by it. Most of the stories are based on the small people of Kauai, the island of Kauai. And so I chose Kauai as the backdrop for the book. And what really got me thinking was, I was looking at an April 2005 edition of National Geographic, where there was a story. It was The Lost World of the Little People. In 2003, scientists discovered a child-sized species of human that was believed to be extinct 12,000 years ago. And what was interesting is this child-sized human species. It's not modern human like you and I, but it was a child-sized species of human, lived alongside modern humans. And so there was a lot of discussion, well, how would it have been, you know, a small race of people like this, what kind of prejudices would go between, you know, the larger race to the smaller race? I drew on that, and I actually, you know, had reverse prejudices. Were the small people against the large people? Getting back to this discovery, which was on the island of Flores, even at the times of low water, like during the Ice Age, the island of Flores was always an island. And scientists believed that nobody could get to the island, could have migrated to the island until modern man came along some, you know, 4,000 years ago with the ability to build boats. And when they dated tools, they found that this hobbit, they nicknamed this child-sized human hobbit, they found that the hobbit was there long before modern man, and so therefore they had to have had the skills to build a boat. So I took that and legends that child-sized species were seen, as late as the Portuguese sailors in the 12th century, and then even later. There's other islands that have their legends of small people. And so I took that legend and I thought, okay, well, what if in order to get away from modern man, this child-sized species got on a boat like the Tahitians or you know, Columbus, anybody that sailed off to a new world, what if they got onto their to a boat and sailed off and actually were the first inhabitants of Hawaii? And then later lived along the, when the size modern, beside modern human man, when the Tahitians arrived here. And, of course, following the legend, I have them living underground. And what happens is Jack Farrell's sailing back to the island of Oahu, and he's sailing past Kauai, and he discovers a fog, a mysterious fog. And when he sails into the fog, investigating it, he finds a ship or a sailboat that's in trouble, and he, of course, saves the woman, and then later dives down and finds a child-sized skull. And he learns that the skull is that of this hobbit, but it's not a 12,000-year-old fossil. And then he and his friend and some scientists begin to investigate, and they embark on a journey underground in search of clues as to where the skull came from. And, of course, the entire book then takes place underground.
And what I find fascinating, is, of course, is not only your detail to the research that's being done, but one thing that a lot of Americans don't realize, of course, is the amount of history and, I guess you want to say, secretive about Hawaii, because people kind of forget that Hawaii and Alaska sometimes are even states because they are so far away from the mainland, especially Hawaii. I mean, heck, it's almost halfway to Japan when you're flying. I mean, it takes you about 5.5 hours from L.A. to get there, and you're talking an 11.5 plane ride to Japan. So, I mean, it's pretty much almost halfway. So a lot of people kind of go, they get on the beach, but they don't really understand the history, and like you said, and the culture, and how everything is kind of, you know, built in this Polynesian community. And so you're one of the only authors I can ever remember that ever even kind of put those kinds of settings, you know, around Hawaii. I mean, heck, Jack Farrell and Magnum P.I., two most famous people in Hawaii.
Isn't that true? If Magnum was a little younger, he could play Jack Farrell. So,
right. You have Tom Zellia, there's this Magnum and Jack Farrell doing their thing. And so when you're kind of constructing these kinds of stories, and you have all this history, and you have all these different stories that have really never been told, because I was sitting here listening, and I said, I haven't heard of that. And you're bringing her to bring it to life. I'm sure that a lot of the fans and the people that when they read the books, they kind of have the same idea. Like, they had no idea about any of these kinds of mystical things that happened with the history of inside Hawaii, and it's more than just volcanoes and pineapples.
Well, that's absolutely right. Hawaii has a lot of myths and legends, and in my book so far, I've only touched on two, the Menahuni and the Night Marcher. And they believe very strongly in both of them. I mean, who's to say the Menahuni don't exist? There's certainly a lot of evidence out there to say that they could. Like I say, Kauai is rich with Menahuni legend. And they have the Menahuni Ditch. Who built that? And even into the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, there's evidence of old stone walls to suggest that people once at least tried to inhabit those islands. What I tried to do in Cave Dweller is I tried to bring life to a legend, that could be. And you can sit back and say, yes, I can believe that. You know, maybe some of the things that take place you might arch a brow at, but when it's all over and done with, you sit there and say, yeah, that could be. And what I've done in the end of Cave Dweller is I've left the door open. And though the book ends, the door is opened that somebody could say they could still be out there. So that's what I tried to do. That's what I tried to do with Cave Dweller, is make people aware of the legend and that they could still be there and have a fun read, a fun adventure, suspense that will take somebody to a place that likely is not they will never go to, the subterranean lava tubes of the Hawaiian Islands. And they're everywhere.
Yeah, and one of the things when I was reading the review, and again, we're speaking here with author William Nickel, and you can visit his website as williamnickel.com, N-I-K-K-E-L.com. One of the things that I find interesting is on one of the reviews, it calls you a latter-day Jules Verne. And, of course, you would probably say that he's one of the godfathers of action-adventure stories. So when you see something like that and what you constructed, how does that make you feel as an author?
Oh, well, I love it. I believe that was that author Gary Braver, or was that James Rollins?
That was author Gary Braver, yes. Yeah, Gary Braver.
I'm very flattered by that, that he would say it. And it tells me that I did what I was trying to do, so in my story. So I'm very happy.
And you, as a, you know, outside being an author, you used to be a police, you used to be a police officer, and you used to work in Kern County out here in California, Bakersfield, which has its share of fun little tidbits that you could go on. So why did you kind of decide to maybe not go more of the police procedural way, which I guess would have been more of a natural move that got you involved to say, you know what, I like action adventure, more of these kinds of stories and with the historical presence behind it?
The best way to answer that is I lived it and did it. And though I very much enjoyed the work and learned a lot from it and grew a lot from it, you know, my thoughts, I've always fantasized. I've always been a daydreamer. And for a lot of years, well, from the time that I was old enough to basically know what I was doing, I was an artist. And for a while, I did wildlife artwork and had a bit of success doing that. But I wasn't satisfied. I'd done it for all my life, 20 over 20 years, 30 years I was an artist, and I just was not feeling satisfied. And when I decided, okay, write a book, you can say a lot more with words than maybe you can with a canvas. And I got into writing. And, of course, it was easy or natural for me to think, okay, write a police story. But then I thought, but that's not what I want to write. As a kid, I was a dreamer, you know. Growing up in the late 50s and 60s, you played outside. You made up games. You played with your toy soldiers or whatever, and you made up stories. And, you know, we didn't have the games that they have these days. So I was a dreamer, and I always loved making up the story, and so it was natural for me to fall back on that. And what I'm doing now, I'm living more the adventures that I always dreamed of having that I never could do when I was with law enforcement. It seemed like I was always working, because you don't have an 8-hour day. But and especially working homicide, I think I worked about 80 hours a week instead of 40. So, now I'm living the adventures, and I'm writing the adventures. And I'll continue to do that. I feel very good about it, and I like writing a good story that people can read and feel good when they're done with it and feel like they've gone on an adventure that they themselves would like to do or dream to do.
So it sounds like the stories came first, and Jack Sparrow was the character that you then created to be that perfect protagonist to fit within the stories that you wanted to tell.
That's correct. Yeah, I had dabbled in some writing prior to my retirement from law enforcement and moving here to the Hawaiian Islands, but I never really settled on a story, a solid protagonist. And once I got here and was surrounded with the myths and legends and got the ideas of, okay, crafting a story around those myths and legends, that's when I came up with Jack Farrell, the character that would most suit doing that. In Night Marchers, you have the Captain Cook. And what happened to, you know, I mean, only parts of his body and some of his items were recovered when he was killed on the Big Island of Hawaii. And I bring those back along with Hawaiian antiquities when a ruthless antiques dealer is trying to steal them. And he goes after the person, and there's an adventure involved there of going after this person and recovering artifacts. So, but in the middle of all that is woven the Night Marchers myth, which is the ancient warriors that wandered the paths at night. You know, like you think of Halloween or something like that, of the ghosts and goblins coming out. Well, these Night Marchers, you know, and there's people that say they've seen the torches of the Night Marchers walking along the cliffs on the Kamehameha Trail. Basically, it was a path that went around the island. And, you know, and there's stories of them walking through people's living rooms. And there's quite an interesting tale of how to avoid being harmed by these Night Marchers. And that's in the book as well. And I won't go into it. I'll save that for a treat. And I do want to say that you brought up that this is a re-release. I have written the four Jack Farrell adventures, and I have a fifth that's ready to be published now. A re-release. I want to let everybody know that I'm quite excited about this. I'm very excited about the re-release. New energy, new book covers. I think the stories are very good. People will enjoy them, and I think this re-release will get them out there for everybody to see. I was once told that people don't want to read stories about adventure stories about Hawaii. But I think they do. I think people are becoming more and more aware of Hawaiian culture and that it is part of the United States. And I think there's an interest in it.
I mean, yeah, let's face it, our president was born there. And I do believe that our president was born there, people, just so you wanted to ask that question. I mean, come on. But, I think that's important because it is part of the United States that you really don't hear. It wasn't involved in the Civil War, really wasn't involved in World War One. I mean, of course, it was big in World War Two, and I think that that's what only people remember is Pearl Harbor. They remember Hawaii, all the volcanoes and the pineapples, and it's a great tropical honeymoon destination. And, you know, December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked it. But besides that, I mean, there's still so much stories to tell. I'm sure each island has its own little myths, has its own little legends that go on because it's made up of seven islands, and some are, you know, not as modern as the Honolulu, of course, and Maui, and then the Big Island. I mean, they're all out there. So I think it's fascinating, and I want to thank you so much for, you know, kind of bringing it to the attention of us and being able to write great stories like that with Jack Farrell at the helm.
Well, thank you, and I will continue to do it. I'll have to come up with a new legend now. The next story doesn't take place here either. So I have actually two stories, one that takes place in California and has to do with the Joaquin Murrieta mystery, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And that's Marietta Gold is the name of that one. And then the new story takes place in South America, where there's a modern day gold rush going on. But I want to come back to the Hawaiian Islands, and I want to do another story here. So maybe that's what's next.
Well, William, we want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about, of course, Cave Dweller and all of Jack Farrell and the exciting information and things that you have going on with the stories and with the series. So we just want to thank you again for coming on and sharing that with us.
Well, thank you very much. And before we go, I do have my Max Travers series out there. That's I took a little step away from my normal and did a steampunk zombie western, and that's
Devil Wind is the name of that. Devil Wind.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, I am just finishing. That's the next story in the trilogy, which is Dance with the Devil. So that'll be going to the publishers probably at the end of the week. But if you like steampunk, these are very much westerns with a steampunk twist to them. They're fun stories, so you can look out for those as well. But yes, Jack Farrell is near and dear to my heart, and that's where I'll be going next.
Well, again, William, thank you so much. Again, everybody, William Nickel, williamnickel.com, N-I-K-K-E-L, and check out a lot more information you got going on. So enjoy yourself, enjoy Hawaii, and have a great day.
Thank you very much, John. I'll do that. Back to work for me all now.
Right. That is. So again, everybody, that is author William Nickel, and the book is Cave Dweller, comes out March 25th, 2014. So we'll be out here in a couple days. And again, we want to thank Sandra Parshall for being on the show and talking about her book, Poison Ground. Again, just some quick notes. This is our last show until April the 26th of Suspense Radio. We will be out of town for that time, for a little extended period of time, and we'll be back on April the 26th. But Crime and Science Radio has got going on, Stranger Than Fiction going on, so we have a lot of things that are still happening here at Suspense Radio to keep you going up. And now you have no excuse to be able to go back and listen to some of the other great shows and some of the other great authors that we had interviewed not too long ago with John Land and Robin Cook and so many others here we have been blessed to be able to have here on Suspense Radio. So again, everybody, goodbye. Until then, we will talk with you all. SuspenseMagazine.com is the website. Check it all out and have a great one.